Welcome to Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm Hopeton Hay. My guest is Amanda Johnston. She is a poet and executive director of Torch Literary Arts. She is a writer, artist, and the 2024 Texas Poet Laureate. She has over 20 years of experience in nonprofit management and earned a Master's of Fine Arts in Creative Writing from the University of Southern Maine. She is the author of two chapbooks, GWAP and Lock and Key, and the full-length collection, Another Way to Say Enter. And Amanda, welcome to Diverse Voices Book Review.
Thank you so much for having me.
Why don't we start off with a poem?
Sure. I'm going to read We Named You Mercy after Gwendolyn Brooks. And this is from my book, Another Way to Say Enter. I count the years after you, know your would-be ages, and remember the sadness that consumed me with the bitter sound of you, my almost children. Could not conceive in conceiving you our muted heat and awe that got through heaven's gate to become that half-wing that was your soul, was you. I saw your face once, and yes, I did kiss your cheeks and cry for your sweet, not quite nose, not quite lips. Would I get another chance to see you if I held the knife, cold, the sterile taker's tools, my hands bloody and damp? In the darkness, I felt your toes bloom small petals against my ribs, your closed eyes pulps of possibility. Did you see me, the one with empty arms stretching to embrace a silhouette of you, a ghost with little more than hope for history? Or did I make that up to keep you with me a little longer? Did you stay until the no I set upon your body untangled itself from sprigs of hair and released you from the softness that tethered you to the love in our cold mercy? Quieted blues, your singers whose band tucked away their baritone horns, and my chosen grief. How those little workers of sadness gathered me up, my heart that splintered with your hard stop. I will never know the joy to have handled your urgent cries against my chest or thirst for the almost milk that did not swell, but was light as air.
Wow. That's a very deep poem, and hearing you read it brings it a lot more meaning to it. There are a lot of layers to that poem that I'm sensing. So talk about the inspiration for that poem and the emotional layers to it.
Well, the poem is inspired by Gwendolyn Brooks' poem, The Mother, and it's a form after Terence Hayes' form, The Golden Shovel. So what that form is it takes a line from another poem, and it uses each word from that line is the last word on each line of your poem. So the end words of this poem are a line from Gwendolyn Brooks' poem. The line is, you remember the children you got that you did not get, the damp, small pulps with a little or with no hair, the singers and workers that never handled the air. And so Gwendolyn Brooks' poem is about abortion. And I was inspired to write that poem, first trying to understand my own experience as a mother and with someone who strongly believes in choice and has had to make choices in my life. And then also capture the reality that it's hard, right? Like, it's very private, very intimate. And it's never an easy decision. It wasn't for me anyway. And I felt like that poem first, poems always for me do the hard work of being my therapeutic expression, my writing to understand, my writing to be present with whatever questions and concerns are filling my body. But then when I turn it into a poem, I hope that it does reach an audience that can resonate with it and find something in it that helps them understand what's resonating inside of them and what they might be experiencing. So in conversation with Gwendolyn Brooks, utilizing craft, inspired by Terence Hayes, and my own musings around motherhood and what all of that looks like.
Well, it looks like there's an emotional layer, there's a physical layer, there's a political layer, all embodied in one. And I think what I really appreciated about this poem is the power that it has. And just how many words is it? You know, 400 words, 300 words.
If that, my poems are always short.
Right, but it's short, but it's so powerful. And I see poems like this can to some degree be part of an agency for change.
Yes.
Part of an agency to take action when you really listen to it, because life just seems so busy. People are so distracted, constantly checking their phones, checking their Twitter, checking their Instagram. But if you just sit and listen to you read this poem and just absorb it, and then to hear you talk about it, I think it has a powerful impact.
Well, thank you. I agree. I am firmly in the belief that arts reflect the times, whether the artist chooses to do that or attempts to refuse to do that, it's definitely still a decision that's being made in regards to the times that we live in. I feel that my work as a poet, as a writer, as an artist is to do that, but then also to share that in that human thread that binds us in a way that might spark action.
Gwendolyn Brooks. If you're of a certain age, you heard of Gwendolyn Brooks.
I hope everyone has heard. If you haven't, please Google
Gwendolyn Brooks. She the first African-American to win the Pulitzer Prize for poetry?
I believe so.
Right. So tell me about your Gwendolyn Brooks experience. What has inspired you about her writing?
Oh my God. Well, for me, even I'm going to be quite frank, when the writing introduces me to someone, but once I'm lit by the work, inspired by the work, I want to know about you. I want to know about your background. I want to know about how you think and see yourself as an artist in the world. So learning more about Gwendolyn Brooks and her life in Chicago. I'm also native from Illinois. I was born in East St. Louis. We moved to Texas when I was very young in 81. So I was raised here, but my family, my people are from there. So just seeing this incredible writer, this brilliant poet from Illinois, from Chicago, make such an impact in the world and not be of the traditional academic schools of writing, but mastering all of their tools inspired me greatly. And a Black woman, especially a Black woman doing that, you know, those were the models that I had to look up to while finding my voice. So Gwendolyn Brooks played a huge role in that.
And she won the Pulitzer Prize for Poetry on May 1st, 1950 for Annie Allen, making her the first African-American to receive a Pulitzer Prize. So I'm quoting Wikipedia. Mm-hmm. So let me be clear.
Yeah.
But I always knew growing up that she was the first African-American to win the Pulitzer Prize. It's just amazing that here we are. Mm-hmm. Talking about someone that won the prize 73 years ago. Mm-hmm. And her legacy still lives on through poems like yours. So what did you first, growing up in East St. Louis and Austin, when did you first feel the drive to make poetry your life's passion?
Oh, well, poetry is always with us, you know. Poetry is how we are first introduced to language through nursery rhymes, children's books, songs. Those are the first things that we hear when we're understanding words and sounds. It's literally our heartbeat. Iambic pentameter follows the rhythm of our hearts. So I just preface by saying poetry is always with us, with each and every one of us. But for me, my mother unknowingly nurtured that when giving me books, she always fed me books. And as a young reader and writer, getting poetry books. But Shel Silverstein, I will always credit Shel Silverstein as being a huge impact on my writing, because Shel, a master poet, masterful. And one of the critiques of Shel when he first started writing was, who would he market to? Would it be adults or children? Because he could go either way in his content and style. But that actually turned out to be like the one of the brilliant things of his writing, is it appealed to everyone. Adults and children both enjoy his work. So Shel Silverstein, my mother gave me A Light in the Attic, and I still have that same copy today. But reading those poems really taught me a lot about form and structure, but also about risk. Because some of the things Shel would write would seem a little naughty. You know, like, oh, what are you saying? You know, we should, you know, there were great poems in there, like Sarah Sylvia Stout Would Not Take the Garbage Out. And it's this poem about this little girl who refuses to take the garbage out until she's standing on this pile that's like consuming her home and her house. He's written poems, you know, about, you know, really, really non-rhyming poems about, you know, children looking and seeing like, ooh, there's scissors on the table. Daddy needs a haircut. He's sleeping on the couch. Ooh, what are we going to do? Should we help daddy? And those type of things, you know, they might seem juvenile, you know, or playful, but I mean, look at me smiling now. They filled me with such joy to read them, and so much power to consider I could write things that weren't necessarily nice. That wasn't the goal, to write things that are just nice, but to write something that is good and honest and intriguing. Shel Silverstein did that for me when I was young.
So talk about working on the craft. I'm a huge basketball fan, and I watch a lot of podcasts with basketball players on Instagram, and I get all these excerpts in there. And there's one thing, as a fan of basketball and growing up with basketball, that I've learned just from watching and reading about them is how much they work on their craft. That the work on the craft for the great players, there is no substitute. And I know it is the same thing for writers.
Absolutely. And I think that's one of the things where I said, you know, we're born with poetry and connected to poetry. And then over time, we're turned away from it. Almost, we don't outgrow it, but we get turned away from it. And I think that's because a lot of people get intimidated by the craft, right? When you start understanding that there's more to the poem structurally, historically, there's more at risk than a rhyme scheme, right? Poems have so much power in them that people can really be intimidated by that. So for me to claim my power as a poet and to work on my craft means understanding, learning the master's tools, meaning the great poets, the great artists, and then being able to break them as I see fit. Being able to make choices within the work. I'm not a traditionalist, but do I know form? Yes. Did I study? And I went to grad school. I studied with Annie Finch, one of the greatest formalists of our time, to understand meter and scansion. And do I adhere to that often? No, but I understand it so that as an artist, I know what I'm doing. I can command my tools when I'm composing a poem.
So who are you? Who's on your literary mountain of the greatest? And if it helps you, no one who's alive.
No one who's alive.
So okay. That you don't have to worry about, you name this one who's living, but not that one. Like if you ask me who's on my list, you know, it's going to be Richard Wright. It's going to be Toni Morrison. I mean, those are just two off. Toni Morrison actually is like at the top of my list in terms of the incredible work she's done over the years, reading the Song of Solomon. And I will confess, I couldn't finish Beloved. I love jazz, Sula, the Song of Solomon. And when you have someone on your mountain, doesn't necessarily mean you love everything that they do, but it just means overall, this is someone who's sort of like the guiding light when I think about those writers that just have inspired me. Who's on your mountain?
Well, I mean, it's no secret that Lucille Clifton is on the mountaintop of my mountain. Lucille Clifton, I learned so much from her. And again,
for the benefit of our audience who may not be familiar with Lucille Clifton, can you give us a little background on her?
Oh, gosh. Lucille Clifton, one of the greatest contemporary poets of our time. So many works by Lucille Clifton. One of her poems, it is, I think, one of her most known poems, is Won't You Celebrate With Me? And that poem in itself is my goal, to be quite frank. If I can write one poem that comes within a fraction of the urgency and power of that poem, then I will have done my job. I will have reached my goal as a poet, as an artist. Lucille Clifton. I mean, there's so much I could say about her. I don't want to please. Right. Again, that's another one. Search Gwendolyn Brooks and search Lucille Clifton if you're listening to this. But her precision with a small economy of words has given me such a freedom in mind. I was fortunate enough to hear a lecture by her and be present and get to meet her afterwards. And someone asked her about her poems being short, that they're not particularly long poems, and why that was. And her response was, "I write short poems, period. End of sentence, no further explanation." And again, like I mentioned at the top of this interview, my poems are typically shorter. If they're a page long, that's a longer poem for me. If they're 2 pages, whoa, I'm breaking a sweat. I'm doing some extra work. And that's just my style. That's how the poems come to me. That's how they manifest on the page. And there's a lot of power in that when you can get the precise word, when you can paint the exact image. That is what I model after. And that has come from Lucille Clifton.
So how did you put together your full-length collection, Another Way to Say Enter?
The collection took, a decade? 10 years. There were some poems that I finished, you know, a few months before the manuscript was finalized and ready for publication. And there were others that I had literally been working on for 5-10 years, trying to get the language right. As MLK says, we got to get the language right. That's how the poems were written independently without a goal for manuscript. My focus is on the individual piece, always the individual piece. And that's one of the things I love about poetry is you should, in my opinion, you should be able to pick up a poetry collection, turn to any page and receive a complete offering. Right. But then if you read the whole book together, you know, from start to end, then that gives you a whole nother level of information and meaning. And it's a complete offering, a separate offering. So I always look at my poems individually. And then once I had, a good number of poems to consider a manuscript, then I started seeing which poems spoke to each other, what the arc would look like. And the title of the book actually came from one of the poems inside it. A line from within the poem.
So let's switch gears here and talk about your work with the Torch Literary Arts. It's a 501c3 nonprofit organization established to publish and promote creative writing by Black women. And you are the executive director. And as any writer will tell you, you always have to have a full-time paying job, usually in addition to the writing you do. So talk about, you can't do it. So talk about the founding of Torch Literary Arts and what the organization is doing.
In 2006, I founded Torch as a place reserved for other Black women writers I wanted to support other Black women writers, knowing the challenges that we face and the joys that we can experience when we have spaces that understand our work, that when we submit work, we know it's going to another sister, someone who looks like us and understands our experiences and our writing. So it was a passion project, though, and primarily online. And we operated like that for several years. I used to do freelance web design, so I just made the site myself and accepted submissions. In the beginning, we received two submissions that really stood out to me, and I'll always remember them. One was from an incredible poet, Linnell Moez, incredible Haitian poet. And she submitted her work actually ahead of the submission period opening, just with the note that she couldn't wait. And the poems were amazing. They blew me away. You can still read those poems online at torchliteraryarts.org in our archive in the 2006 issue. And another submission came from a grandmother, a woman who was in her late 70s, and she said her granddaughters had found Torch, had learned about Torch, and encouraged her to submit. And so for me, that was the exact space where I wanted Torch to thrive, was for emerging, very emerging writers. I love when Torch is someone's first publication, all the way to experienced writers who have had incredible careers and are still, you know, doing incredible work, but may not have had the opportunity to be in conversation with other Black women in the way that Torch provides, because those opportunities are very rare, sadly.
So what is the work that Torch is doing today?
So in 2022, we relaunched with the goal to provide more opportunities. After the pandemic, we realized we need more, not less. So we relaunched with our 501c3 so we could do more fundraising to be able to pay all of our features. We moved from doing one or two traditional issues a year to publishing on Fridays and monthly features so that we publish more per year. All are paid features. For example, in our first 15 years, we featured approximately 150 writers. Now we feature between 40 and 60 a year. So huge increase there. And giving more support and opportunities through our Wildfire Reading Series. We feature notable local and Texas writers, and as well as writers from outside of Texas at independent bookstores in Central Texas. So we have readings at Bookwoman, at Black Pearl, at Resistencia, and we're hoping to do some things with Book People soon. So come out to some of our live readings for the reading series. But then we also offer professional development. So for workshops, for crafts, so that folks can take a workshop with notable authors, or to take a workshop that's dealing with your building a writing career and what that looks like. So from the writing and the professional aspect of it through our workshops, and our workshops are available to BIPOC women at no cost to be able to attend. And then we launched our retreat this summer, which is very exciting, a week-long, fully funded retreat for writers with works in progress. So six fellows came working in poetry, fiction, and screenplays, and were gifted a week of uninterrupted writing and rest, which is something we need. We need to be cared for and allowed to rest and dream for our creative works to come alive.
Talk about the importance of audiences coming out to hear these writers from two sides. One simply is there's no more power in me to me than hearing a poet read their work live in person. There's nothing more powerful than that. But at the same time, for poets and writers to be sustained, it's good to have audience to come out to see them.
Absolutely. I mean, literature is one of the most powerful things that we have to document our times, but be in communication with each other, right? And then when you're able to hear the writer share their work live, you're able to get notes and essence of that work that can't be translated through the writing alone. So it's a very special opportunity to be able to be there when it is fully embodied by the artist who wrote the work, right? So it is very powerful. So for the audience to come, and then you have that voice in your head, then you have that passion and the energy from the author, when you can then take the work back and read it in solitude, it's going to empower your reading of the work. It's going to add an extra layer to understanding of that work. But then for the writers themselves, it's twofold. Yusuf Komunyakaa said that once. The work that a writer does is only ever going to be 50%. It is complete when the reader gets the work. So we have to have that arc, that bridge complete for the work to be at its full power. So for authors to be able to see how their work is received by an audience, to be in conversation with their audience, and then to be supported and funded so that they can continue to do that work is essential. It's essential. It doesn't happen, you know, separate from our lives. Our writing is our lives. So our livelihood matters. To be able to keep producing the work, it has to also be funded and supported. So buy books, buy lots of books.
Also, I think if you can't see a poet or read their work out loud, I think a lot of poetry is probably meant to be read out loud by the reader.
Mm-hmm. You should read it out loud. You should listen to it sonically. There's so many layers to poetry. And for me, it's impossible for me to feel that a poem is complete if I have not read it out loud multiple times. It's like playing music. When a metric foot, you know, a syllable lands on the wrong place, it's like playing the wrong note. Or if the emotion or the sentiment in a section of the piece falls flat, it's the same. Something, the music was out of tune. And you can't always pick that up if you don't hear it out loud.
So why don't we close with you reading a poem?
Okay. I'll read one more poem from Another Way to Say Enter. This poem is titled Facing Us, after Yusuf Komunyakaa. My black face fades, hiding inside black smoke. I knew they'd use it, damn it, tear gas. I'm grown, I'm fresh. Their clouded assumption eyes me like a runaway, guilty as night chasing morning. I run this way, the street lets me go. I turn that way. I'm inside the back of a police van again, depending on my attitude to be the difference. I run down the signs, half expecting to find my name protesting in ink. I touch the name Freddie Gray. I see the beat cop's worn eyes. Names stretch across the people's banner, but when they walk away, the names fall from our lips. Paparazzi flash. Call it riot. The ground. A body on the ground. A white cop's image hovers over us. Then his blank gaze looks through mine. I'm a broken window. He's raised his right arm, a gun in his hand. In the black smoke, a drone tracking targets. No, a crow gasping for air.
Wow. I mean, this has been some of the most tumultuous times of my adult lifehood, but all that has gone on with the deaths and the civil disobedience that's going on. And clearly you've been inspired to write about that.
Absolutely. You know, there's no way that you haven't seen it. You either, as my mother say, you learn about something and you either do something about it or you try to ignore it. I'm not the ignoring type. Especially not when it's my people, when it's my family. And these are real fears, right? That divine, we say we live in two Americas, when those are real fears, when you see what's happening, and it's not new by any stretch. The videos might be new, some coverage might be new, but the abuse and the harassment and the killings in an unjust society are not new for Black people and people of color. So that's a real fear that we live with every time my family and I step out of the house. Could this interaction become something more? Should an interaction happen? But seeing definitely through Black Lives Matter from 2014 until now, with the undeniable recordings and then still no convictions, no charges, it's just been infuriating. But as a poet, that's how I work, and that's how I speak to the larger world. So there's no way I could see that and not write about it.
Amanda Johnston, poet, writer, executive director of Torch Literary Arts, and your website is, we're going to need both.
Yes, my personal website, amandajohnston.com, and for Torch, you can visit torchliteraryarts.org.
Thank you so much for being a guest on Diverse Voices Book Review.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm Hopeton Hay, host and producer. The theme music is provided by Wright Productions. You can follow the show on social media. Under Facebook and Instagram, it's Diverse Voices Book Review, or Twitter under @DiverseBooksHay.